All right, well, today I'd like to talk a little about taxes. I'm going to cover the following topics. First of all, I'm going to talk a little bit about why reasonable people should debate taxes, holding revenue constant. Then we're going to talk a little about who actually pays federal taxes, and I'm going to lump together all of them, Social Security, excise taxes, and the burden of corporate income taxes. But then I'll talk about how poor folks respond to taxes. Mostly what I'm going to talk about today is how people actually change their behavior. Is this working okay? In response to taxes. Then we'll have to kill this. Okay. Then I'll talk about how the rich respond to taxes, and we'll notice the big difference between the poor and the rich is that pretty strong result. A lot of economic theory is all about on the one hand, but on the other hand. But here, when it comes to capital, we've got pretty much just a one-handed result. And then if I have a little time, I'll talk a little about the Laffer curve and why it doesn't seem to matter. So, holding revenue constant. I want to say that it seems to me that sensible debates about taxes really should start here. There's a lot of if you want to talk about spending, that's a topic for another day. How big should government be? That's a worthy topic. But once you've had your debate about how big you want your government to be, then bring in the tax economists. I'm not actually a tax economist myself. I just play one at Mercatus. I'm a growth economist, a macroeconomist by training. But bring in your tax economists then, and they'll tell you, okay, once you've decided this is how much government you need to fund, here's the best way to fund it. Here's the least distortionary way to fund it. Here's the way to do it that doesn't create a whole bunch of incentives for tax shelters and your smart people retiring at the age of 50 and people working under the table, things like that. That's what your tax economists are for. So after you've decided you need to pay a bill, here's the best way to get the money. So sad to say, the government you're going to have today is going to be paid for through taxes. Either present taxes or future taxes. If we had saved a lot in the past, we could have spent our old savings to pay for stuff. That'd be a nice way to pay for things, you know, like trust fund countries. Those got to be a great place to be, right? Just pay for your current spending out of old savings. But we're not in that boat. So it's either present taxes, future taxes, or printing money, which fortunately is not important in the U.S. So who actually pays federal taxes? Here's a chart from the CBO, which gives a sense of how this works. This is all federal tax liabilities, not just income taxes. And the CBO has done the best they can here to try to measure real households, actual households. A lot of these numbers you see about tax returns, what they're really looking at is they're including every parent who gives $2,000 to their kid and has to file a tax return because of that. That gets counted as an extra return. You don't want to count those people. So the CBO is doing the best they can here to actually look at real households, what a normal person would think of as a family. And, of course, what you see here is that the people in the lowest quintile hardly pay any taxes. They do pay some federal taxes. We'll look at that number in a moment. And the other big point to take away from all that is that across the board, in the bottom quintiles, this is the bottom 20%, the next 20%, and then here's the highest 20%. Across the board, all of these groups are paying less than their share in income in the form of taxes, and the folks at the top are paying more than their share in income in the form of taxes. So, for example, the folks down here have about, a 60%? The top 20% of Americans earn about 60% of the income and paying about 70% of the taxes. So maybe that's the right number. I don't know. But they're paying. I don't know much about fairness as an economist, but I know they're paying more than their share in income. So here's the raw data that's based underneath. You can look at this is all CBO. I just pulled it up off their website. So this breaks it down by the exciting part. This is the group that I hope most of you are planning to be in someday. So a couple years on the Hill, go off and work downtown and see what happens. So the top 10% in 2005 earns about $340,000 a year. The top 5% about $500,000. The top 1% about $1.5 million. This is pre-tax income. And that top 1%, I mean, $1.5 million pre-tax income, that sounds pretty good to me. I'd be pretty happy with that. They're paying about $500,000 of that in federal taxes. That includes both income taxes, Social Security taxes, like federal excise taxes, and their share of the taxes that the CBO is sort of calculating how much they're owing out of from corporate income taxes that get passed through to them in the form of dividends, things like that. So the CBO is doing the best they can to look at all those pass-through taxes. Now, you get some corporate profits, but you pay some taxes on those profits. So the folks in the top 1% paying about 31% of their total income in taxes. One interesting fact, if I have a second to talk about this, is that if you look at the volatility of income over time, like how things bump up and down, there's been a very clear trend over the last 30 years that the incomes of the top 1% have grown at a much faster rate than the incomes of folks down here. Another interesting trend is that the incomes of the top are vastly more, incredibly more volatile. They just jump around up and down. So in the last recession we had, between, say, 2000 and 2002, if you look at those years off of the same CBO data, the people in the top 1%, their average income went from a little over $1 million to a little under 700,000. So that's like a 20%, well over a 20% drop. So folks at the top 1% are, they have volatile incomes, but I mean, heck, when you're, you know, when $800,000 is a bad year, you know, you can't really complain, right? But the point of this that matters for tax policy is that the U.S. tax system has chosen increasingly to sort of put, to try to put some of the burden on the folks up here. And so if you're going to tax these people, that means you're going to live like these people, which means years of feast and years of famine. Now, if you're rich, I mean, what's a $700,000 a year famine, right? But if you're the Senate Budget Committee or the House Budget Committee and your numbers are going to go swing by 20% from year to year, that's a big hassle to plan around. So just keep that in mind when you're thinking of putting shifting more of the tax burden toward these folks, is that definitely want to save for a rainy day if that's your strategy. Because they seem to. So there's one big question in labor supply, and that's, are you in or are you out? Okay? For most Americans, the big decision is not, am I going to work 10% more hours or 10% fewer hours? And am I going to take a little more overtime? Although in certain sectors, overtime is pretty important. The big question is, are you in or out? Are you in or out of the labor force? So you're going to work or are you going to stay home? Are you going to retire 2 years earlier? Husband and wife sitting around the kitchen table saying, okay, do I stay in the labor market for another year or two, or do we just call it quits now and go into semi-retirement? Do you hide out in grad school when the economy's bad? Do you think that getting that degree will actually pay off? The decision, and then there's the decision to work in sort of above the counter or under the counter work, above the table or under the table work. So do you decide to work as a waiter where you earn hard to tax tips? I mean, we know that's how the world works, right? So, or do you work as a restaurant manager where on paper you get a much bigger salary, but you got to report it to the man, right? So those are the big decisions, are these big discrete decisions, these big career choice decisions. The big decision to turn off the TV and get a job versus the decision to just, you know, watch another couple episodes of The Dog Whisperer. So let's look at how people actually respond to these big in or out questions. So the Earned Income Tax Credit is one of these great experiments that lets us see how people really respond. And there's this literature review by Issa and Hoynes, and it's published by the MIT Press, but you can get that free online, so as with most good things in econ nowadays. So the Earned Income Tax Credit is a big, successful anti-poverty program, and it's a big pro-work program. You only get the EITC credit for wage hours, for hours worked in a salaried or wage position. So right now, this is 2004 data, so you guys changed the rules too much around here for me to keep really current data here. So the EITC covers, at least in 2004, covered about 22 million families. Average benefit, pretty big, $1,500 a family. That's just an average. And so just to give you the high-end estimate of how much this can affect people, we're talking about a 40% wage subsidy to a two-child family. So if I make an extra $10 in the labor market, I'm getting extra $4 from the feds in, when I get my tax refund. So that's a pretty good deal. So people really, if taxes really do influence behavior, this is where it ought to show up. And if taxes don't influence behavior, if it doesn't show up here, then taxes probably don't influence people's behavior that much. So let me talk a little bit about the science of how we actually learn stuff in economics. How do you actually check to see if this happens? So one way you could do it is you could just ask people. You could survey. So my colleague Brian Kaplan is a big fan of surveying people to find out what they're like, because sometimes people are pretty honest. But one way to do it in practice is that your bosses actually help economists really a lot, because you change your laws often, and sometimes you do them pretty randomly, at least from our point of view. So that creates an experiment that's like, okay, there's this world called 2002 where people get a big EITC, and then there's this other world called 2003 where people get a smaller one. So it's almost like having two Petri dishes, one where you put the medicine in and one where you don't put the medicine in. So that's one way we do it, is just random changes, hopefully random changes in the law. There are fancy ways to check when it's random or not, correct for that, but that's the big story, is big expansions, big shrinkages in EITC. So I actually, when I was in grad school, I was a big beneficiary of the EITC, and I'm very grateful to the IRS for helping me out with that. So then they tightened up on it for single people with no kids, so I didn't get as much later on. So, but what did I do? I just borrowed more. There's a lesson in there, but that'd be another talk for another day. So you can, another way to do it is, if you can't just watch the same people over years and see what happens, you can just statistically do these comparisons between people who have no kids who aren't really getting much EITC, people who have one kid who get the medium rate, and people who have two kids who get the highest rate, and see how, on average, those groups of people behave. Some of these state governments have really good data on who's getting these credits and who's not, how much income they have. And so, like, California in particular does a good job keeping track of folks. So you can really check and you can answer this big question: who works? But of course we know who works might not really mean who works. It might mean who works above the table. Because for a lot of folks, the decision is, do I babysit my neighbor's kids for a couple hours for a little cash, or do I go and get a job and then have to pay a job that pays enough to pay for a babysitter? So it's under the table versus over the table seems to matter a lot. So Ice and Hoynes, they sum up a lot of these studies, and they found that they were actually kind of shocked. They noted, they said, it's strange that no matter how people did these studies, whether it was the experiment over time with a law change or whether it was comparing different kinds of people at the same time, you got the same answer, roughly, which is that if there's 10% more take-home pay, so if you're making $7,000 a year, if you get an extra $700 in EITC credit, it looks like on average you get 7 to 12% more workers. So if I want to simplify that, I'm really a fan of trying to remember numbers in memorable ways. And this is rounding up a little, but it's 1 for 1 isn't a bad way to remember it. But notice, because 10's kind of in between, it's almost an average. So if work pays, it looks like people work, and if work doesn't pay, you can fill out the blank there yourself. But notice here that from the point of view of a newspaper reporter, from the point of view of a newspaper reporter just going around talking to low-income people and asking them what they're doing, this newspaper reporter could go and survey a lot of people who would not be changing their behavior at all, right? You'd have to survey, if these numbers are right, suppose you have a 10% boost in the after-tax wages from a big boost in EITC or a big cut in income taxes. Either way, it's the same thing. The journalist would go and survey 10 people and ask them, so did you do anything different because of this? Did you do anything different because of this? Did you do anything different because of this? Out of 10 people, how many of those would say, no, I didn't change my behavior? 9 out of 10 would say, I didn't change a thing. And that would be the honest truth. 1 out of the 10 would be changing their behavior. So most people not responding at all. But most people not responding at all is the same thing as 1 for 1. So realizing that the journalist point of view of I talk to a couple of people and treat that as reality gets me something different from when I just take the helicopter point of view. How do things look from way up high in the sky? Wow, I see 100 people, and when I give this big boost to the EITC or a big cut in income taxes, say a big cut in Social Security taxes for low-income workers, I would get 10% more people working. But, you know, a busy reporter might only survey 2 or 3 people. That's considered a news story, right? 3 anecdotes is a trend. That's the rule of journalism. So the world of journalism has some good insights, and economists often cite, you know, newspaper pieces, but sometimes you'll miss some big things if you avoid the big data. So notably, the EITC just doesn't have to seem to have much effect on hours among those who are already working. Once you're in, the EITC, if anything, makes you work a little less. But that doesn't seem to be enough to swamp this big effect. So the big decision is, as we said before, it's in or out. So now that we've looked at folks who are subject to a really strong package of incentives, let's look at sort of the average person. Let's look at all Americans together. Economists have done, you know, dozens, hundreds of studies looking at how taxes change behavior. And one way to sum it up is to just go and ask the economists. I could spend a few slides just summing up studies, but here's something that Fuchs, Poterba, and Kruger did about, now it's 12 years ago. They went and surveyed a bunch of labor economists and said, okay, you know, how much do people respond to changes in their take-home pay? And for our purposes, that's basically the same as changes in their taxes. So if you raise somebody's taxes by 10%, that's the same as cutting their take-home pay roughly by 10%, as long as you're starting from a low tax rate. So the universal response, almost universal response of labor economists is that women respond more than men. In your slides, I actually had it as married women because that's the usual result, but I double-checked the survey, and this particular survey just asked about women overall. Working-age women, I think the categories are something like ages 18 to 44, something like that. They went and asked economists at the top 40 research universities, you know, Harvard, Yale, Princeton, UC San Diego, Wisconsin, a lot of places. So ask them, you know, how much do people actually respond if you change their take-home pay? And the answer for women was that women kind of respond to a modest degree. A 10% rise in their take-home pay, you get about 5% more hours worked. That's for the aggregate, the whole. So that's including people entering the market. That's the in or out decision, plus do I work a little overtime, that decision. Do I nag my boss to go from part-time to full-time? So adding all that up together, it looks like that number's about what most economists think. And then with men, it's a much smaller effect. Men are not good economists. They don't respond to incentives very well. So women are good economists. They respond to incentives. So the other surveys seem to show that low earners respond more. So that actually helps explain why there was the 1 for 1 result. That we got 10 for 10 before with the low earners. And this matches about with that. And it looks like high earners respond less in terms of hours. And there was a very nice survey. I think it was a Harvard University Press book. And the title of it was Does Atlas Shrug? The Economic Consequences of Taxing the Rich. And in terms of hours, there isn't much evidence that high-income earners shrug at all. They're basically, they work full-time plus. And they do that, you know, until they're very old. So There doesn't seem to be a lot of shrugging along the dimension of hours, but we'll see. Maybe there's other ways to shrug other than putting in this mechanical thing called hours. Now, I should mention that somebody a lot more famous than me thinks that all these numbers are wrong that I'm showing you, and that's Ed Prescott, Nobel laureate, inventor of real business cycle theory, which deserves a talk on its own. He thinks that these numbers that I'm reporting you are all about are way too low. He thinks the real numbers are 10 times bigger. So in his, he thinks that if you raise people's take-home pay by 10%, you get about 30% more hours. Maybe not in the short run, but in the long run, and for society as a whole. And he looks at this because he compares numbers across countries, and seems to find some. He thinks he finds evidence of this. Most of his, even his colleagues, people who are pretty sympathetic, think the number's a little smaller than that. But he thought it was so important that when he got to give his Nobel address, you know, he gets to speak to the King and Queen of Sweden, he decided that a whole portion of his speech was about why a 10% rise in wages causes a 30% rise in hours. He thought that was important enough to speak to the King and Queen of Sweden about. So he got the trip to Sweden, not me, so I should at least mention his argument. If you want to argue for that, if you want to argue that there are these big behavioral responses to taxes, it seems like you're going to have to argue for sort of social forces. There's some elementary work that seems to show that this matters, that you kind of look at what your friends are doing, and people have a modest, human beings have a modest tendency to conform. This is one of the great insights of sociology, is that people tend to look around at what's going on in their neighborhood, and they say, well, whatever my friends are doing, I'm a little more likely to do it. I want to fit in. I don't necessarily want to be the coolest guy in the neighborhood, but I don't want to be the lamest guy either, right? So, you know, so if so, the way this story would work, if social forces are pretty important, as economists are increasingly coming to think that social forces matter and that we can measure them, that you look at people and say, so this guy, he got a 10% wage increase. He got a tax cut, so he decided to work just a little bit more. And then his neighbor, all of his neighbors are just a little bit more likely to work because he's, well, this guy's kind of working. Now I learned maybe he told me where some good jobs are. Maybe there's information passed through from your friends. So maybe there's local cultures that help pass on these, that turn these small effects into big effects. So that's really just at the beginning of work. I'd say it'd be another 5 years before we can get a sense of how big those forces are. So when we talk about taxable income, taxes in the rich, we're looking at a group of people who are very smart at thinking about taxes, much smarter than I've ever been, certainly. But so when I talk about this, I'm going to do a little bit of hand-waving. I hope you'll agree that it's substantive hand-waving. So I'm hand-waving in a particularly insightful direction. So for the rich, the question is not just, am I in or out of the labor force? You know, do I take the job at Tasty Freeze or not? Okay, that's not the whole thing. I mean, that's an important question for some people, right? So I enjoyed my time working at McDonald's. I never really got that good at the chicken nuggets. I could never time them just right. So, but I learned a lot about keeping bathrooms clean. So the rich don't just have these simple decisions of in or out. They are looking at things like, should I invest in this sector or that sector? Should I do things that are, for example, investing in real estate, which tends to be a tax-favored activity, or should I invest in corporations, which tend to be a little bit higher taxed on average? The U.S. tax code has enormous, enormous subsidies for enormous incentives to encourage people to invest in real estate, as you all know, both for the ordinary folks and for big corporate investments. Should I work as a wage? Should I get wage labor, or should I find some way to turn my income into capital gains? Should my spouse work, or should my spouse like sort of do a lot of volunteering, build some connections so that we have friends in the neighborhood, so maybe I can think about running for Congress someday? So, and here's a more important thing. So there are a lot of dimensions. Some of those might matter, some might not for what we're talking about. But here's a big one, which is taking an easy job versus taking a hard job. So do I climb that next rung on the ladder? I know I'm going to be working 60 hours a week. Do I want the 60 hours with something a little cushier? Or do I want a 60 hours a week where it's always some like huge chest pounding, ego destroying job where I'm having to fight all the time? So this decision of what kind of work to take seems to be important. So here I'm doing the hand-waving part. We'll see in the data. It looks like this hand-waving stuff actually matters. So let's take a look at what some studies. Oh, this slide almost came up, right? You can never trust fonts too much, I guess, right? So how much do the rich change their taxable income when taxes change? So the stuff I've talked about so far has all been about hours, the decision to go into the labor market or out of the labor market. Here I'm talking about your total taxable income. You might think of it as your wages. I mean, in a simple case, if we ignore all the extra stuff. So people can do a lot of things to change their behavior so that they earn different amounts of money, even holding their number of hours worked constant. So Martin Feldstein, who used to run the National Bureau of Economic Research, he's still at Harvard, and he's a member of he was on the President Reagan's Council of Economic Advisors, and he's now a member of President Obama's Economic Advisory Panel, the one run by Paul Volcker. So he actually pioneered this research, saying, you people looking at hours, you don't actually know any rich people, do you? So he found that if you change people's take-home pay, the percentage of their income they can take home by 1%, their taxable income rises by about 2%. That was such a huge number that generated, and it's much bigger than, in other words, that 10% rise in your the fraction of your income you take home. So if instead of keeping 70% of my income, I get to keep 80% of my income. This implies that I would create 20% more taxable income. So a 10% rise in my fraction that I get to keep is a 20% rise in the actual amount of taxable income that shows up on my return. It's a huge number. So this was such a big number that it got a lot of other people to go in and work on this and say, is it really that big? Is it really that big? And as so often in these things, you know, once people look at 10 or 20 or 30 of these studies, you know, the reason the first study got published is because it was a really big number. Like, it grabbed people's attention. I mean, it helped that Feldstein has, it could be Feldstein, I apologize if I'm getting that wrong. He had an excellent reputation as doing good work on taxes. So, you know, that's part of the reason people paid attention. It was such a big number. So people have looked at this for a number of years. His first study was like 1995 or 96. And then Gruber and Seitz a few years ago used a bunch of fancier statistical techniques and tried to check and see if it was really that big. They found a number that was quite a bit smaller, but still, well, much higher than, say, the numbers I was pointing out before. So a 1% rise in, say, so this means that, for example, a 1% rise in your tax rate, if I can think of it that way, 1% rise in your tax rate gets you to create about 0.6% more income. A 10% rise in your tax rate would lead to about a 6% rise in your income. That number is still...
Tax rate?
Yeah, let me think of it that way. I mean, I'm trying to, like, simplify it here. So it's the fraction of your income that you get to keep for yourself. That's the right way to think about it. So trying to talk about this without talking about marginal and average is a little cumbersome at times. But 10% causing 6%, that's like the responses of women to work, like the average American woman. The way that the average American woman responds to hours, which is something we usually think of as pretty big. People like to say, oh, that's pretty big. You know, women, they're the rational ones. They respond to incentives. 10% causing 5% more hours. Well, with the rich, when you look at income instead of hours, a 10% rise in their take-home pay would cause about a 6% rise in their hours. So it's about the same ballpark, which is, again, it's showing that this composition stuff matters. It's not just about in or out. It's not just about the hours, especially for the rich. It's about what kind of work do I do? Do I climb the next rung in the ladder? And again, I should mention that Austin Goolsbee as Chicago has found out what I think has got to be the lowest estimate in the literature. This is at the low end. He looked at the 1993 tax increase, which was everybody anticipated, right? So Bill Clinton came into office and says, I'm going to raise taxes on high-earning Americans. And so in December of 1992, folks who were these high earners were trying to find every way they could to earn money in 1992 rather than 1993, right? You want to earn the money when the taxes are lower. And so what Goolsbee did is he looked at the incomes of top executives and tried to find what they did over time. And he found that in the short run, there was a huge amount of end-of-year gaming, basically reporting income in 92, trying to find ways to sell stock or trade options in end of 1992, get your big bonus in December 92 when you couldn't get it in January 93. A lot of that short-term gaming was a very big effect in the short run, but he didn't find as much of an effect in the long run among this group of high-powered executives. Interestingly, he found that about a third of this effect, when he added it up, because he adds up all the people by about their share of income, about a third of the effect was just Michael Eisner. I mean, it was amazing. Like, who would think Michael Eisner would get mentioned by name in the Journal of Political Economy? But he did. I mean, it was big enough that you have to mention him. So I've got some time. So let me talk a little about taxes on capital. So far, when I'm talking about income and the rich, I'm just sort of lumping everything together. Now let me talk a little bit, some of the facts first about the income of how income in the U.S. gets split up. So in the U.S., two-thirds of income, this isn't about taxes, this is about income, two-thirds of all U.S. income, if you measure it like GDP, it's wages and salaries. So that includes things like bonuses too. So, and one-third of income is things like, economists call it returns to capital. That is interest, it's rent, it's profit, all that. So two-thirds, one-third. This is a split that has held true across time and across countries. Even you have to get down to the most extremely poor, almost fully agricultural economies before this starts to break down. And even then, it still roughly seems to hold. There was a nice study done a couple years ago in the Journal of Political Economy that showed this. So this holds true, that this two-thirds, one-third split seems to be like almost a law of economics. Well, it seems to be a law of economics. And the reason I can say it's a law is because we use it extensively. We use this law everywhere in all of our models. If you're writing down a model and trying to get something published that violates this two-thirds, one-third split, you're really going to have a tough time with your journal editor. They're going to say, why are you changing this? This is something that it seems to be a fact. We're not sure why it's a fact, but it does seem to be a fact. So the funny thing is that it's also true across countries. So you would think that the U.S. versus Europe, you know, the Europe, you know, has a much stronger group of union protections, worker protections, and so you would expect that as a result, workers would get a bigger share of the pie than the capitalists, but it's not true. Olivier Blanchard of MIT has actually noticed that, if anything, the effect's just the opposite, where in Europe, the share of income going to capital is a little higher than in the U.S. Not quite clear why. I could spend an hour talking about the reasons, but this is just the raw fact. The raw fact is that, if anything, in Europe, the share of capital, share of income going to capital is a little higher over there. And the funny thing is that it's true across time, too. I mean, the U.S. economy has been through so many upheavals across the decades. But all that time, this share has held roughly constant. The capital share goes down in recessions and goes up a little in recoveries. Recessions aren't a conspiracy of the capitalists, right? They're actually worse off in recessions. So as a share of the pie. So it's a strange law, and it seems like it's been tough to budget. So people have, like you said, you know, Europeans have an incredibly pro-worker, pro-union economy. You would think that would be good for boosting up this share in the war between capitalists and workers, but they haven't changed a thing. If anything, it's gone the other way. So that's just a fact you have to work with. So it seems like a iron law. Maybe it'll change in some future, you know, 1,000 years from now, but it's probably not going to change the next week. So let's see about what
economic theory has to say about taxing capital. So when it comes to, like, the right way to tax workers, you know, economists don't have these huge iron laws. I might talk a little about some of the, you know, tin laws we have, but when it comes to taxing capital income, we do have an iron law, and it's one that I think is kind of weird. I didn't expect it to be true. It's known as the Chomley-Judd result. If you go to Google Scholar and look at Chomley-Judd result, you'll get hundreds of hits. It's a shockingly robust result, which is that taxing capital income is a bad idea, and not just because, oh, look, it's bad for the capitalists. The even more shocking result, which is something that Chomley stuck in his original 1986 paper, he said that workers themselves, if workers were the only ones who had the vote and they actually knew how the economy worked, and it's a pretty straightforward way of saying how the economy works, just machines help workers do stuff. The result is that future-minded workers would actually vote to tax themselves, not the capital. So how does this mechanism work? So here's the obvious point. If I tax capital more, I get less of it. So there's lower long-term saving. In an open economy, in a globally open economy, there's less machines coming to the U.S., fewer machines getting imported from other countries. So that's lower long-term saving and investment, and that means you get fewer machines to tax. So that's the obvious point. If I raise the tax on something, I have less of it to tax. That's not enough to generate this, though. If that were the only channel, you would still want to tax workers and capital and spread it across the two. The subtle point is that if you have fewer machines, then workers produce less, which produces lower wages, because machines help you do your job. So for you, people often see machines as the competition, and in some ways they are. Machines are in some way the substitute for you, right? So, you know, if a machine can do your job, you're going to be doing something else. But machines also help the average person do their job, as the long-run trend, of course, is that we have vastly more machines than we used to per worker, and the average wage is much higher than it was 50, 60, 70 years ago, apparently because of the machines, not despite them. So this is the subtler point, that the fewer machines means the workers can't produce as much, and so they earn lower wages. And so the story is, and I make my PhD students actually prove this mathematically, is that even if you take all the capital tax revenue, so let's say you had you're going to tax the capitalists, and it's just a small tax, maybe a medium-sized tax, and you take all that money and just give it to the workers, the workers would still say, well, actually, I'd rather have the extra machines that would exist if you didn't tax capital. So that's the insight of the Chomley-Judd result. Showing exactly why it works out that way is beyond our scope. But it's one of these things that was so surprising when it came along in the 80s that a whole lot of people spent a lot of time trying to write theoretical models disproving it and trying to find little loopholes to make sure it wasn't to knock it down. I don't know if I mentioned many of those. No. The best that you can say now, it's been 23 years. Chomley actually just wrote another paper that kind of followed up on this. The best you can say is that it kind of depends a little on how machines help workers. So if machines are actually even better than economists normally think, if you need new machines to help implement new ideas, or if a new computer can help you search for new drug formulas faster by creating computer simulations of molecules, which is what chemists do nowadays. So if machines can actually help you come up with more new ideas, then you may actually want to subsidize capital. You may actually want to subsidize in the same way you subsidize the EITC. Subsidize poor people with the EITC. So that's one result. You may want to subsidize capital rather than leaving it untaxed. You may want to tax it a little bit rather than leaving it untaxed. You may want to notice that human capital, education, is a lot like machines, so maybe you should make investments in education tax deductible so that it gets treated about like capital does. A lot of results that come out of this, but they all come to the same result, which is that taxing capital is a bad idea. There was a Minnesota Fed study that I read in grad school that was just the title of it, Taxing Capital Income, a Bad Idea. Now, what's one good reason to tax capital income? It's that You know, if you tell me that labor income is getting taxed, but capital income is not getting taxed, I have a pretty strong incentive to say that whatever I'm earning is now capital income. Right? So, you know, if I have a choice between earning $100,000 a year in salary, or if I have a choice between selling you this fantastic t-shirt I just made for $100,000, and then, oh, by the way, I'll work for you for a year for a couple of bucks, I know which one I'm going to choose, right? So it's the tax administration feature that might be pretty important and might be a reason why you'd want to tax capital income, is because it's just fairly easy to color wage income as capital income. So people have again, those crafty rich folks with their fancy attorneys are pretty good at finding ways to color high taxed income as low tax rate income. And so that might be one tax administration reason for wanting to say, okay, even though in theory it would be nice to do this, it still might not be able to implement in practice. And of course in the U.S., as I mentioned on the earlier slide here, IRAs and 401ks and the deferral of capital gains, a number of other features of the tax code, do help us get close to this zero tax rate on capital. So overall capital income is taxed at a lighter rate than other forms of income, partly because of the preferential rates, partly because you don't have to pay for the tax and for a lot of these things until you sell the product, until you sell the shares, until you sell your bond, and partly because we've had pretty generous carve-outs in IRAs and 401ks that let people save it with incredible amounts of tax deferral. So we're part of the way toward that. So if you actually went and surveyed a bunch of economists and asked them, again, this is that same survey as before, where they surveyed people at the top 40 schools, and they said, well, what if we switch from it to this Chalmley-Judd tax, you know, to a pure consumption tax, which is the kind of what you've seen over time in the U.S., or national sales tax, or a full expensing income tax, where you can deduct the full cost of your machines and equipment the first year. The universal savings allowance tax, I think that's an old one that came around. So any of these accomplish the same thing with some different bells and whistles. And they asked a bunch of these guys, well, what would it do to the economy in the long run? And they said, well, the economy on average would grow about 0.2% faster per year. And that would add up to about being 10% richer in the long run. So the people, and that's, maybe that'd be noticeable. To me, that's like watching the grass grow a little bit faster. I don't know if I can notice that. But 10% richer in the long run is nothing to sneeze at. Right? If I had 10% more Xbox games, just how much better would my life be? You know, 10% longer vacations, you know, 10% more ties, that'd be great. So the optimists in the survey, the people who were at like the 75th percentile up there, they thought they were a little more optimistic. They thought the economy would grow 0.5% faster for quite a while, which would make us about 25% richer in the long run. So that'd probably be noticeable. So I do have a little time to talk about the Laffer curve. So this is one of the perennial favorites of tax economics. Apparently you can't write an economics textbook without including the Laffer curve in there somewhere. Because, you know, people think it's an interesting thing to talk about. So Art Laffer made a famous diagram on a cocktail napkin once. He was allegedly sitting with Paul Gigot of the Wall Street Journal and Jude Winiski. And they were at a hotel. They were at a restaurant in D.C., which I believe is now defunct. I just forgot the name of it. And what Laffer pointed out is that, you know, if the tax rate's 100%, a government's not going to raise any money because people do everything under the table. It's not that people won't work. It's that they'll do everything under the table, right? It'll just be, we'll all be criminals, right? So, and if you have a tax rate of 0%, you get no revenue. And Laffer just pointed out that somewhere in between, you know, if you pull the tax off of 100% down to 90, you'll raise some people will go work in the legal sector, and they'll do less game playing. And at some rate, there'll be some equilibrium, some highest maximum revenue point. So I just pulled this graph off the internet. I didn't make my own. So one point to notice then is that the Laffer curve tells you that for any revenue, amount of revenue you want to raise,
There's two ways to get that level of revenue.
You can have it at a low point here. You can have the low tax rate and get that level of revenue. Or you can have a very high tax rate and get that level of revenue. So, you know, most people would probably choose this one. So, I mean, it's hard to tell what everybody would do, but most people would probably pick that one. And so Laffer made this point back in the 70s when the top federal income tax rate, top marginal income tax rate was 70%. So an extra dollar that you earned was meant 70 cents of it went to the federal government, and then if you live in some states, it'd be another 10% to the state governments. So you're taking home very little at the margin. And Laffer thought, you know, especially for these people at the top, 70%, like, people are doing a lot of gaming at this rate. They're probably coloring a lot of their wage income as capital income. They're probably taking less interesting jobs. There's just a lot of ways for people to play with this. And they might be retiring early. You know, if somebody retires at 65 instead of 63, you know, that's just, you know, two more years is about 5% more work for the typical person. If you've got a 40-year career, two more years is 5% more work. So there's all these ways that people can choose to respond to taxes. And Laffer said, I think you could do something by cutting taxes on the top and you wouldn't lose that much money. So that was part of what motivated the Reagan tax cuts, where the top rate went from 70 to 50. And I think most people who look at that say that rate cut from 70 to 50 did pay for itself. That one thing did pay for itself. Even Brad DeLong, who was a blogger of some prominence, he's a prominent professor at Berkeley, very important contributor to monetary economics and economic growth research, and he worked in the Clinton Treasury as undersecretary. He said reducing the top tax rate from 70% to 50% is probably a revenue gainer and surely not much of a loser. So he had his doubts about other tax cuts over the years, whether they've had that same effect. But those kind of incredibly high ones seem to be a big deal. Now, Laffer seems to be a little annoyed that some people have taken his ideas, interpreted them as saying that all tax cuts pay for themselves, or all marginal rate cuts pay for themselves, or all supply-side rate cuts pay for themselves, something like that. He keeps noticing people say this. He says, I've never said all tax cuts pay for themselves. I never even said that Reagan's tax cuts would pay for themselves. I said this in Time magazine, 2 years ago? Actually, a little over a year ago. So I thought this was a great quote to point out. So the point of the Laffer curve is that there are some places, certainly in this range, if taxes are in that, you know, if you've got taxes at 70% rate and you can drop them to 50, you're probably on the wrong side of the Laffer curve. A new study by Harold Uhlig of the University of Chicago seems to show that there's really no evidence the U.S. is anywhere near the top here, but we look like we're more like around point A here for our tax system. But he says Europe, especially with Europe's wage taxes, it looks like they might be right around here. And the thing about being up here is that you can cut the tax rate a lot and not lose that much revenue. So he thinks Europe has some stuff that's right around there. That's Uhlig's study. Harold Uhlig's a pretty sharp guy. Uhlig. He writes papers that are quotable and answer interesting questions, and he uses sophisticated statistical tests so that it's not just a bunch of... he's not just reaching wish conclusions. He's getting to the facts. So with my conclusion then... I think good economic debate should talk about holding spending constant. So we should talk about how we should raise this much money. If you're looking for somebody to read on taxes, that's just a good, reasonable person who speaks sensibly, I think. And he'll point you to he refers to the best stuff. Alan Auerbach of Berkeley, he runs a public finance institute there. It started back when I was a grad student at Berkeley many, many years ago. And he's been there ever since. Our tax system is really progressive, but the question for you is it progressive enough? You can make it. You can change that. Whether to work, especially for the poor, is a much more important question than how much to work. But the rich do a lot of nuance. And the final fact that I should leave with it is that capital taxation may be bad in theory, but of course, theory can't drive everything, because there's another theory that says that
I really would love to sell you that t-shirt. So...